Back together, you and I sitting down, chatting it up halfway through the month of July, Monday, July 15th, 2024, right here on Connecticut Today. We started a brand new week with my thoughts on turning down the heated rhetoric of the current campaign season after the weekend assassination attempt aimed at former President Trump. Quinnipiac University law professor John Pavia stopped by. He explained a judge's decision to drop, for now, the federal classified documents case facing Mr. Trump. University of New Haven senior criminal justice lecturer Ken Gray stopped by. He talked about Saturday's assassination attempt against the former president and the apparent security breakdowns that were seen by many. And finally, Southern Connecticut State University Associate Professor of Political Science and Urban Affairs, Dr. Jonathan Wharton, discussed the prospect of toning down the political rhetoric in the U.S. So at this point, we still don't know a heck of a lot about this 20-year-old man who fired shots at President Donald Trump in Butler, PA on Saturday, nearly killing him. You saw that that bullet grazed the top of his right ear, and doctors are saying if he had turned his head another half inch or an inch, the story might be very difficult to deal with, might have been the worst possible scenario. So be that as it may, the guy is being described as a loner who was constantly bullied. How surprising is that? There was interviews with his classmates over the weekend saying, hey, yeah, unfortunately, this guy was constantly picked on. That's another story, and I'm sure they are and have already talked to relatives. I guess the long gun was a semi-automatic that his father legally bought. So that's a complete other story. And also the aspect of how he was able to get on top of that building with a long gun, with a decent amount of power, almost assassinating Donald Trump. And he was up there, even though people were motioning to police and to security, we think we see somebody up there. That's all going to be spliced out over the next few days. I've got an expert today. I've got an expert tomorrow coming up on that. But may I say this to start the show today? It's wonderful to be back here on a Monday. And by the way, if anybody is listening who I met yesterday, it was great to meet you last night, Hartford Healthcare Amphitheater outside the Rain Show. So it's great when we get out and about, all the people here on WICC and all our stations, to meet those folks. Now, having said that, let me let loose with this, because my head, you know, my old buddy, my old pal Glenn Beck, who I used to work with, one of Glenn's favorite phrases is, get out the duct tape, Maud. You're going to need it to keep your head together. Please, please. And I know some of you are thinking this, and I'm going to say it. What happened in Butler, PA on Saturday was horrible. It came within a fraction of an inch of being even more horrible on another level, to the point where we would have been nationally confused today. But be that as it may, you people out there in the political world, all right, please spare me the sudden I found Jesus here. Well, you know, we need to tone down the rhetoric. Oh, the rhetoric. Number one, let me ask you something. Is there any information or any evidence? Now, we may find that out. I'm anxious and interested to hear that, but they said this 20-year-old young man, sadly, who apparently had problems, they're saying at least at the outset, and this may be, you know, fine-tuned and corrected as the investigation goes on, they say this guy was, as they can tell, apolitical, but he was bullied. So it's not like, at least at the outset here, that there might be a political aspiration to this assassination attempt. Okay, we know that. We don't know if there's a political angle. But please, can I tell you, I was yelling at my radio in the car. People must have thought I was nuts. All the people, and especially you people out there from, sad to say this, from President Joe Biden on down, everybody suddenly has found Jesus on this. Everybody is singing kumbaya. Everybody has herb tea and biscuits now that we have to tone down the rhetoric. Oh, isn't it rich? As that song goes, send in the clowns. Isn't it rich that so many of these people, at least on one side of the aisle, who are saying that, oh, we have to turn the volume down and the rhetoric, which is not a bad thing. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. It would be a really good thing if Democrats and Republicans turned down the rhetoric a bit. You can still argue policy, but we can take it down a notch or three. Back when it used to be kind of boring in the Bush 41 years or the Bush 43 years or the Bill Clinton years, whatever. But please, you folks from the Oval Office on down, you're telling us to turn down the rhetoric, which I say is a good thing, but yet you're the same people who would, at the drop of a dime over the past year or so, basically call Donald Trump a Hitler in waiting. You were called, oh, he's a dictator. You couldn't go 10 minutes in the news cycle, 24/7, 365, for about the last year, year and a half, without hearing some Democrat or somebody from the administration say, well, you know, democracy is on the ballot this November. The inference there being, well, half the country that's going to vote for Trump is against democracy. The inference being, and it wasn't hard to find, wannabe dictator, likes Chairman Mao, Pol Pot, Joseph Stalin, Hitler. All the Hitler references, that's like grabbing a bag of Skittles, grabbing that big fistful of Skittles. And suddenly, these are the people that are saying, well, now we need to turn this down. Is there any evidence that this disturbed young man who took a shot, multiple shots, sadly, killing a firefighter, wounding two other people, is there any evidence this is political? Yet, we don't know. But even if it is, please, from Joe Biden on down, spare me. Spare me the garbage of us having to turn things down, which in and of itself is not a bad thing. But that's like hiring a burglar to be a home security consultant, of which there have been. Sometimes these companies hire ex-thieves to point out vulnerabilities. Well, this is kind of what's happening right now. The people, the very people from the White House on down into the local Democratic Party, the same people that were saying Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, fascism, they couldn't say fascism enough, are now saying, please, can we draw down this? We have to get civilized. Are you serious? The hypocrisy on this is 10 feet thick. It is mind-boggling. And listen, President Biden did what he had to do. Over the weekend, twice or two or three times, statements and TV, televised statements and a release statements. But come on, please. Has he read the texts of any of his recent speeches? It goes with Trump. This has gone beyond good, hard campaigning. The very same people, the hypocrites, the absolute hypocrites that were calling Donald Trump a dictator in waiting. You're kidding me? Come on. You're the ones telling me that we have to hold things, we have to calm down right now. And now look, that is something I have said over and over again would be a good thing. If politics got boring again, it would be good, not bad. It wouldn't be as sexy. Listen, it wouldn't be as what's the word I'm looking for? It wouldn't be as calorie rich as it is when it's contentious for programs like what I do here and the all news cable channels. But my God, when you got, you know, Joe Biden and all these Senate Democrats and everybody who was basically saying, if you elect Trump, you know, here comes Nazi Germany again. And for channels like MSNBC, who are, you know, every day I got to look at them up on the monitor here, say, you know, breaking news, seriously, they run stuff on that screen like, you know, Trump's plan to destroy democracy. But wait a minute, hold it. Maybe we should back it down. My God. 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. It is. And here's the thing. People are being good right now. They're biting their tongues. Largely, you don't think the entire Republican voter base wants to throw a big middle finger at the White House from on down? Now, that's not something that I would do, but please, come on. Please. And as somebody in the office today pointed out to me, and I didn't stop and think of this, you know, the Mr. Biden, now everybody says, you know, well, hey, by the way, how about that replace Biden thing? That's been kind of calmed down, huh? But you don't think President Biden is the imprimatur or has the final say as to how he wants his campaign conducted through his surrogates? You don't think he has the power to say, hey, you know, prior to this Trump shooting, could he have said, listen, let's tone it down a little bit. It's getting a little too rancorous here. But man, every soundbite I heard or every appearance over the past few weeks from the Biden folks, well, democracy is on the ballot. How often have you heard that over the past year? Democracy's on the ballot. And yet, now the people are let loose with that phrase every 5 seconds. Now they want to, we have to tone down the rhetoric. Because, you know, this is getting awfully nasty. Please spare me, all of you. The other thing, the other big story concerning Mr. Trump today, along with, of course, the aftermath of the assassination attempt and also the aftermath of his VP pick, which looks like it is going to be J.D. Vance, the senator from Ohio, is the fact that Judge Aileen Cannon tossed, at least for now, she's going to allow an appeal of that, the classified documents case. And joining us right now, we've talked to this gentleman before on this specific case is Quinnipiac University law professor John Pavia, who was with us. John, good afternoon, my friend. How are you?
I'm well. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Not too bad. John, what did you think when you saw the word break that Judge Cannon, although she's allowing an appeal of this, is saying that this choice of a special prosecutor is unconstitutional? Explain to my listeners what's going on here.
Yeah, so I wasn't surprised. This has been kicking around for a while now. And so what the judge in this case found was that the appointment of the special prosecutor, Jack Smith, who is the federal prosecutor bringing this case forward down in that court, was not appointed under any statute that really gave the attorney general authority to appoint Mr. Smith in the first place. And what people, not to, I don't want to turn this into a law school course, right? But I think what the technicality here is that people should be aware of is this. Under the Appointments Clause in the Constitution, the president has the exclusive right to appoint certain officers, and other officers and the appointment of those officers can be delegated to Congress. And to heads of departments, if there's statutory authority given to the head of a department to do so. So, for instance, when we talk about appointing ambassadors and whatnot, those are superior officers or principal officers. In the case of inferior officers, and I'm getting into definitions, this is such as an appointment made by one of the head of any of the departments, Department of Commerce, Department of Justice, et cetera, those inferior appointments that are made by those heads of those departments are made pursuant to some statute, usually, that Congress has passed. In this case, there's no statute that, according to the judge, that she can find that gave Merrick Garland the right to appoint this special prosecutor.
Interesting. And that would have required John Judge Cannon to simply go back and look at precedent and look at history, as you say. Has this ever happened before? Is that what this boils down to simply or not?
Yes and no. So by precedent, well, let's start with this. This first required the judge to look at the statute and say, okay, clearly, in her opinion, if this is either a principal officer or an inferior officer, it's probably an inferior officer. So let's assume for a second that the head of the department, in this case, the Justice Department, might have the ability to appoint an inferior officer. Yeah. Now the question is, under what statute? Now, when she looked around for a statute, her opinion was none of the statutes that were cited by the Justice Department qualified as anything that gave the Attorney General the authority to appoint this special prosecutor. So she then looked at precedent, and the precedent goes back to the appointment of special prosecutors in the case of Richard Nixon. Now, in that case, the Watergate case, it's very interesting because this same issue has been kicking around since then, because back then there really wasn't a specific statute that gave the Attorney General the right to appoint an independent counsel. Years later, a statute was passed that gave the right, that created that right, and that was the statute that Ken Starr was appointed under. And what was interesting is that statute had a sunset provision in it, and it expired. So as soon as it expired, which was over a decade ago, if not more, this issue started coming up. Does an attorney general have the right to appoint a special prosecutor, being that there's really no independent counsel law on the books anymore?
Yeah, John Pavia, I remember. I mean, I'm getting up there. I'm old enough to remember because I was kind of fascinated during Watergate. And, I was like 12 or 13 back then, and watching that day to day got me the itch to get into this business. But I do remember, now that you mention it, there was a big question of whether or not, I think it was Archibald Cox and some other people, like should they even have been appointed back then? And, there was no authority to do that. And that's the scenario you're talking about here, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so, again, this issue has now come forward, and the judge in this case, in her opinion, I didn't read it's 93 pages, I didn't read the whole thing, but I read a good portion of it, even says that this is really a case of first impression down in this circuit, which is the 11th Circuit down in Florida. She's a district court within that circuit. And she finds that, there is nothing on the books, that no statute that she can find that Congress has passed that authorizes the Attorney General to appoint a special prosecutor. And what's really important for people to remember is, forget about politics for a second, because I know there's been a lot of talk about this judge who was, I believe, appointed by President Trump, coming out with some decisions that are questionable. This is an issue that's a very legit issue. Forget about how you feel about Trump. Republican, Democrat, doesn't matter. This is not a bogus issue. This is a real issue. And there has been lots of scholarship on this and lots of arguments back and forth over the years as to whether or not an attorney general has the right to go ahead and appoint an independent counsel since that independent counsel law expired many years ago. In other cases, we've had presidents appoint independent counsels. But in this case, this came right from the Attorney General. So this is a legit issue, and she came out on the side of Trump.
Yeah. John Pavia, professor at Quinnipiac University Law School, joins us here a couple of more minutes regarding Judge Aileen Cannon saying that it was unconstitutional, at least at first glance here after she looked at it, that the special counsel was appointed in this case. Yeah, I know, John, this feeds into the question of, and I've read in some very conservative circles that have said independent counsels in and of themselves are unconstitutional. But this, John, this does not, I mean, I guess people should know this. I know I have some listeners who were not happy with this. This does not in any way, John Pavia, absolve Donald Trump of a possible crime here. Does it not, or does it?
No, this has nothing to do with the merits of the case. This is purely on constitutional grounds having to do with the authority of this attorney to be the prosecutor prosecuting the case. This has nothing to do with whether or not Donald Trump was right or wrong in having those classified documents in his possession at Mar-a-Lago.
So John, the case can just then go forward, correct? What is the thinking, John Pavia, of, well, we need a special prosecutor here? Is that just to create, John, the image of a buffer between, you know, what they would say, what some conservatives would say is a weaponized Justice Department? Can't the Justice Department just prosecute this because they think it's a crime?
Yes, they could. However, remember that the reason, the whole purpose of a special prosecutor going way back is to try to alleviate and, if not resolve, the issue of potential conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that the Justice Department is part of the executive branch.
Yeah.
So to have the executive branch investigating and prosecuting the executive branch, you have a conflict. And so the whole concept of an independent prosecutor, the whole concept of actually having special prosecutors in state jurisdictions. You know, states have the same thing.
Sure.
Where, a lot of states have laws on their books that allow the either governor or the lead prosecutor in that state to go ahead and appoint a private attorney in private practice, where they sort of deputize them as an independent counsel because there's some kind of conflict in that office prosecuting the person who's at the center of the investigation. That's the whole basis of having independent counsel laws. So that's the purpose for it. Again, though, you have to have, according to this judge, you have to have some basis, some legal basis, a statutory basis, a law that says you have the authority to go ahead and appoint this person.
Got it. Well, John, thank you as always for making this stuff understandable to us non-lawyer folk. Quinnipiac University law professor, Professor John Pavia. John, thanks. Be good. And we'll talk down the road, my friend. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. There you go, Professor John Pavia. They just don't give you a bang for the buck. Our next guy always does. He gives us quite the insight we need when stuff doesn't go wrong. Ken Gray joins us. He lectures in the Criminal Justice Department at the University of New Haven. Ken, with a long law enforcement and counterterrorism career, including stints in the FBI and in the Navy in various capacities. Hey, Ken, it's Paul here. Good afternoon. How are you?
Hi, Paul. Glad to be with you again.
Well, thanks, Ken. Good to have the time. We appreciate it. I know you're jamming today with interviews. Well, Ken, let's get to the elephant in the room here. I'm sure if you weren't watching it live, as most of us weren't, it was a Saturday. We were just out. I was at a friend's house at a very nice pool party, and all of our phones started to blow up, and we went to the TV and gathered around there. When you got to see, Ken Gray, what happened, maybe on a replay several times, when you looked at the layout of that fairgrounds there that Mr. Trump was, what immediately hit you in regards to what happened?
So I was shocked, of course, as was most Americans, that this was able to happen. And then upon looking further into this, I was really shocked that this was allowed to happen. This was a failure on the part of Secret Service to plan this out. The building that which the sniper got up on was clearly within the threat area and should have been both swept and then somebody on top of that building, or at least denied access to that building so that it would no longer be a threat.
Ken, you talked about the area they look at. So in and so this was what, about 130 yards, or somebody said that, about 400 feet there. So in this sort of area, Ken, now it's different. It's rural. It's not in the city. I know that makes a difference. But what is, Ken Gray, in this sort of a rural area, what's the absolute limit or circumference or range here that would have to be just locked down? Is there a set figure, or does that determine on what's there and what's around it?
It really depends on the setting. U.S. Secret Service uses a multi-tiered approach to this, concentric circles. The inner circle, U.S. Secret Service is responsible for the security within that. The next outer layer that goes around that they do along with state and local police. And then the furthest reaches, the outer rim, that is going to be local police only that is out there, local police and state police. And so in this particular case, U.S. Secret Service was relying upon the local and state police to patrol the area there outside the rally, but close enough that it might be a threat. And they failed to detect this person getting up on the roof. They failed to detect the fact that he could get up onto this roof. And despite the fact that the local law enforcement failed to stop that, U.S. Secret Service is ultimately really responsible for it because they were directing the activity of the state and local police.
Ken Gray is with us from the University of New Haven. Ken, also, we're reading stories now in second and third hand accounts, but there are enough of them who say, Ken, that there were people who, I guess, reportedly, and they've been freely saying this on all the networks, they saw, I guess, the alleged shooter or somebody probing around on the roof. They looked over there, and apparently they say, we tried to warn people, tried to warn the officers, and try screaming at him, pointing, hey, is there somebody on that roof? And unfortunately, that might have gone for naught. Now, I don't know how accurate that is, but if that's true, Ken Gray, that's even a worse black eye.
So the sheriff for this area said that one of his municipal officers actually was lifted up, put his fingers on the roof, and lifted his head above the roof. They didn't have the benefit of the ladder, but instead an officer had to lift another officer up. As he was lifted up and he peeked over the edge of the roof, the shooter turned his weapon towards him. And since he had both hands on the edge of the roof, he could not reach his weapon.
Oh.
And instead he chose to let go and drop to the ground. When he dropped to the ground, that's when the shooter started shooting. And so he had the possibility of stopping the shooting, but he did not have the position to be able to stop the shooting. But it took a while to get an officer over there to take that peek over the edge to see that there was somebody actually on the roof.
And Ken, as you have told me numerous times, and as other security officials have told me, because Lord, I've never fired a live round of ammunition, but isn't Ken Gray the usual? Now, again, you said this depends on the third layer, the local law enforcement, but is it not unusual for the Secret Service, Ken? And maybe they said this, we don't know yet, I'm sure it's going to come out in Congress. Hey, we need somebody on that roof. That roof has to have an active armed officer or an agent on top of that. Wouldn't that be the protocol, Ken, or not?
So before the rally even started, weeks before, there was an advanced visit to the area. That is the time in which they determine what areas needed to have extra protection. That building should have been identified as an area that would have a grave concern about the possibility of somebody being on top of it. It was only 130 meters away,
yeah,
1.5 football fields. And by the way, Crooks was a member of a rifle team in his high school through ROTC, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And they routinely would shoot out at 180 meters. And so this was an easy enough shot for him.
So what happens now, Ken Gray? I mean, obviously, this is going to be a little different because not only do you have the Secret Service and the FBI, and unfortunately, we're still starting to see, Ken, the kind of finger pointing going on between the Secret Service and the FBI here. So they have to ascertain internally what happened. I guess the House Speaker Mike Johnson has fumed. He's going to have hearings this week. Is this, Ken Gray, a fireable offense? Are heads going to roll here? I know that's tough for you to say from afar as well as me, but what happens here, Ken, to get the message through that this is unacceptable?
So the Secret Service is responsible for the protection, and the FBI is responsible for investigations when it's an investigation of an assassination or an attempted assassination. Part of the FBI's responsibility is to look at where the plan went wrong. So this is clearly within the responsibilities of the FBI to examine this whole thing. That's why if you saw that first news conference, Secret Service was not present because they were the one that had the security plan. So they can't investigate what went wrong with this security plan.
Yeah.
The FBI is they're not going to prosecute the shooter because the shooter is dead.
Yeah.
So their end result is going to be an investigative report. That investigative report, though, will show everything that went wrong with this. And as a result of that investigation, if they find that the Secret Service was wrong in the way that they conducted this, people could be reassigned, people could be fired. My guess is that Kim Cheadle, the director of U.S. Secret Service, she's the one that's going to end up being the one that will have to go over this. My guess is that she is going to be testifying before the House Oversight Committee on the 22nd on Monday.
Yeah.
And I think depending upon what she has to say, we could be looking at a different director for the U.S. Secret Service.
Wow. And finally, Ken, we talk about the failures here, and we have to because it almost cost Mr. Trump his life, no matter what people think of him. Horrible situation there. But, Ken, the actual agents that surrounded the stage that jumped into action, I would guess they are to be commended because, boy, they really, I mean, you saw that training, Ken Gray, kick in, get Mr. Trump down, and then once the shooting had ended, at least as they could perceive, get him into one of those SUVs and get him out of there.
Yeah, President Trump, when he got hit on the ear, he dove to the ground. Then Secret Service piled on top of him. Now, Secret Service should have gotten him out of that venue quicker than they did.
Mm-hmm.
Secret Service policy is to get the protectee away from the threat as quickly as possible. And they seem to take a long time of putting that human shield around his body and getting him off of the stage there. Now, part of that is President Trump, is the fact that he said, "I get my shoes. I want my shoes."
Yeah.
And then he wanted to do the fist bump to get the crowd worked up.
Mm-hmm.
And while that may have gotten him wonderful publicity from that, nonetheless, if there were a second shooter at that venue, that second shooter could have taken advantage of that. So really, you got to get your protectee out of the area sooner than what they did.
And finally, Ken, the shooter was taken out. How was that a Secret Service shooter or an FBI guy?
So it was the counter sniper team.
Wow.
Is Secret Service. So in this particular case, they had several counter sniper teams. Two of them were Secret Service. Two of them were provided by SWAT teams from local police. The ones that took them out, I believe, were Secret Service counter snipers. Counter snipers are not agents. They are part of the uniform division of Secret Service, but they're usually former military snipers that are hired for their skill sets.
I would think so. Ken Gray, University of New Haven. Ken, always great to have you on to analyze these things and break it down for us. Ken, thank you. We'll talk down the road, I'm sure.
Paul, you never call me for something nice.
Yeah,
unfortunately,
Ken, like I say, but you're one of the guys that can break it down for us. Ken, take care, and I'm sure we'll be in touch.
Thank you.
All right. Ken Gray there, University of New Haven, a long career, naval officer in surface warfare, several years with the FBI, authority on counterintelligence, counterterrorism, and cyber intrusions as well. Now, after that, and I opened the show with this, you have people who were firing vitriol out on both sides, suddenly saying, hey, we've got to tone down our politics. We need to tone the rhetoric down. Okay. Maybe, but is that easier said than done? Joining us right now, Dr. Jonathan Wharton, a frequent guest of the show here, Southern Connecticut State University Associate Professor of Political Science and Urban Affairs, and a longtime observer and participant in local politics. John, it's Paul here. Good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Good afternoon, Paul. Great talking to you again.
What did you think, John? I mean, I know it's kind of a loaded question here, but how did you find out what was going on Saturday, and what were your initial thoughts on that?
Well, I was actually waiting for a friend coming in from New London, so I just happened to be watching the news, or at least having TV on.
Yeah.
Like you said, cable, and I was kind of going back and forth with Twitter, of course, because I'm always on Twitter.
Yeah.
And one of my reporter buddies posted it, and I mean, it came right through the Twitter feed even before it hit the TV. And everybody was just responding and retweeting. And within a minute, it was just amazing to see how many replies there were to all of that, at least on social media. And then finally, maybe it was within 5 to 10 minutes, it was on TV. And of course, it made the entire evening news because what it started at about 6:20, 6:25, I got that right. So it became the entire evening news, obviously.
Yeah, and John, I mean, you know, it's the summer. It's kind of the dog days of August, where everything is pretty much decided now and heading toward the conventions. The GOP today nominating Mr. Trump. The Democrats set to nominate Joe Biden. We think, we're not sure, but it's probably going to be that way now. Now, John, all these calls came out, and I kind of suspected this, and you probably did too. Well, we need to turn it down, even though we don't know what this kid's motivation was. They can't find anything particularly political about anything he said. Now, he was bullied, we know that, and there's part of it, but you know, John, in this in July here of 2024, can we turn it down? Is either side going to play chicken here when they say, okay, well, you go first? No, you go first. How would that even work?
Well, and that's the thing. Brian Lockhart had an article where he quoted myself and a couple of other professors in there today in the Connecticut Post about that. You know, will this change the tenor or the rancor of the campaign or the elections? And to be frank with you, Paul, you know, I think you would be surprised. I don't think it's going to be possible. And I said that right off the bat. You know, we are in prime time right now before the primary, before the election takes place in November.
Yeah.
And this is a difficult time because beyond the conventions, few Americans, you know, are really, you know, stuck to this, except for all the drama that's been going on between both campaigns. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's going to come back to these toss-up states, you know, the ones that could go, you know, either way. And we're talking about 6 to 8 states, give or take. They're at play, obviously. And I think that's why you have somebody like J.D. Vance that was picked out today, because Ohio is certainly one of those states.
John, do you think the problem is, does the schism in a lot of the big hot-button topics, abortion, guns, immigration, the border, taxes, is it kind of the schism here, John, that drives the rhetoric, or is it the rhetoric that drives the schism here? Because years ago, and I'm kind of a junkie on this stuff like you are, I read about past campaigns and past voter patterns, and I'm just wondering, is it that we're so divided on these core issues that makes it tough for us to just knock it down a notch?
Well, let me turn that around a little bit for you here, Paul. A part of it is that, and this has been existing for quite a while, really.
Yeah.
There's a certain percentage, certain chunk of each political party that are the real kind of firebrand, you know, partisans. Not even partisan, hyper-partisan, right? So they're the ones who are, you know, kind of the base of the party, and it's not even a big part of it, but they're the loudest, the most organized, and they're the ones who are stirring everything up. Really, the majority of Americans are, you know, nonpartisan, unaffiliated, and overwhelmingly centrist. But you get maybe 20% on each side, maybe 20 to 30, give or take. Everybody's got different numbers on that. They're the ones kind of steering and leading where the directions go in terms of the framing and the hyper-partisanship, if that makes any sense. And it's become more balkanized or more tribal, if you will, as a result of that.
Yeah, and that mentality, John, on both sides, left and right, Democrat and Republican, it tends to freeze out or shut out people who even get into those parties. And like, for example, a liberal Republican who would say, hey, listen, let's back away from the abortion thing. Let's let women make their own choices. Or somebody on the Democratic side, John, who may say, hey, you know, we would win more voters if we really tightened up on the border. But man, those people, John, are stepped on like bugs a lot by the party royals.
Well, it's a great example would be abortion. It would be because people tend to forget this, but there are some Democrats who are actually pro-life.
Yeah.
Including there's a couple of state lawmakers, you know? And so there's just this natural assumption by, you know, so many Americans who are really the partisan fire breathing and the media who highlight, well, everybody who's a Democrat's got to be, you know, pro-choice.
Sure.
Everybody who's a Republican got to be pro-life. No. If you see the polls throughout, it's really somewhere between, we're back to that 20-30% that are overwhelmingly more the other way of what might be perceived the party. We have to remember, keep in mind that, you know, there are divisions and factions within each political party, and not everybody is, you know, this way or that way. On abortion, on guns, I mean, go down the list. You're going to have, you know, people who are not going to toe the line 100%.
John, in the couple of minutes we have left, the Joe Biden situation, did the Trump situation over the weekend, has that cooled that down? Now, he's got an interview tonight with Lester Holt from NBC. But
right.
is the replace mm-hmm. Biden thing done, do you think? Or is there still going to be people worried about big pocketed donors and George Clooney and his Hollywood cronies and a lot of people telling Mr. Biden, please, we love you, but step aside? Or has that been effectively squashed or now?
No, I don't think it's going to go away, Paul, especially because, remember, we got the convention, as you reminded everybody, in a couple of weeks mm-hmm. There in Chicago. And the one thing to keep in mind is that, okay, so if you're going to replace Joe Biden, who are you going to replace him with, right? Because you've seen all the polling that's been coming out. It's been saying that doesn't matter whether it's Biden, doesn't matter whether it's, you know, Harris. Some people have been saying, you know, Newsom, you know, Governor Newsom out of California. Either way, everybody seems to be hovering somewhere between 35-40%.
Mm-hmm.
So... But the big thing I think is that, you know, what if it was something like a Newsom-Harris ticket? The problem with that is we should all know and recognize that that's two West Coasts. You can't just
yeah.
do that all in one state with California. That's mm-hmm. the problem. And so that's why I'm particularly interested to see, you know, who else would be a candidate. Is it one of these governors, you know, that's been talked about between Michigan and Pennsylvania or even Illinois? That could be a possibility because don't ignore the Midwest and all that. That is critical. You need that Midwest support.
Yeah, and finally, John, that's one of the reasons I'm reading by some credible pundits who say part of the reason that they probably would not want to go, at least many people, with Kamala Harris, although it could cost them votes, that she probably would not do nearly as well, if at all, that as Joe Biden would with the kind of, as you say, Midwest, Rust Belt, kind of white, maybe high school educated, blue collar, Democratic union member voter. You know, Joe Biden still does well with them. John, wouldn't it be great, and I know you probably agree with me as an academic on this, wouldn't it be great to see a brokered convention in Chicago? I mean, my God, bring it on. Get me the popcorn and peanuts. Let's go.
Well, especially because this is post-primary,
oh.
right? Because the primaries were already decided, right? The delegates have all been pledged. Yeah, it would be quite interesting to see the really kind of a contested element to this. I got a couple of my friends who are real kind of, you know, people who follow these conventions are
yeah.
really into this, and they think that, okay, this would be really interesting, if not historic and unprecedented. But, I mean, that's just highly unlikely.
Oh, you know, come on.
Got to tell you the truth, Paul. People tend to forget
yeah.
that, you know, parties are enterprises.
Yeah.
They follow the tool line. They follow script. I hate saying it. You know, we tend to forget that. They are that entity to follow the rules.
Yeah, that's a part in life I've never liked. Follow the rules. Dr. Jonathan Wharton, Southern Connecticut State University. John, grab the popcorn. This has been fun, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for thinking of me. Take care.
All right, John. Dr. Jonathan Wharton, who is an associate professor of political science and urban affairs at Southern Connecticut State University in New Haven. Go Owls.